glad I'd shared them around. I had hot pockets in each glove and one stuffed in the front of my knickers. There was sometimes one in my sports bra too. So fucking cold. I needed these warm spots to remind my body to heat the hell up. High on the unavoidable ridgeline, the wind blew ice crystals at me horizontally, stinging my face and brutally blinding me. I could see Fitbit close ahead. She usually runs hot, but had stopped, desperately pushing her solitary hot pocket from hand to hand. I fished out one of my extras and gave it to her as I passed, trying also to give her my spare gloves, but she demurred. 14 miles later, and feeling crushed by the cold, we congregated at a road crossing. No one needed to suggest we call it quits for the day. Everyone was broken. We strung out down the road, trying to hitch a ride a few metres between us. Cars passed in small sets, spraying us with dirty slush and leaving us behind. I figured it was really mean to be left near a hiking trail in this weather by the passing cars, so called each of them assholes after they'd gone by. The wind was howling up the road in the bottom of this valley, and snow swirled as the dark crept up, billowing jackets and burrowing down the back of necks. Some men pulled in for a short hour's hike before dark and told us that this cold weather storm even had a name because it was so rare and scary in November, set to break records across the USA. A large pickup slowed and pulled in. A big man leaned out of the window, warmth and light spilling out around him onto our chapped faces. He asked if we had an emergency, and the other said, no, just looking for a ride, probably wondering why he would have thought so. But then they hadn't seen me at the end of the line, behind their hitching thumbs, making praying signs, waving with both arms and mouthing, please, at the passing cars because I was so fucking cold. Success. We would so appreciate a ride to Troutdale, Bunkhouse said through numb, cracked lips. I'm not sure, guys. I just don't think I have the room in here, and you'll freeze to death in the back. He swiveled his neck to look through the back window. That chink of possibility was all we needed. We perked up and gleefully assured him, we can fit in. And then, with his permission, we made it happen. I'd normally take the truck bed, but I was blue, so I squeezed in the cab, making small talk, and discovering this man surfed all his summers, and his best friend lived in Newquay, a mere 30-minute drive from my house in Cornwall. Our new friend dropped us in a barren, desolate-looking village. In fact, it wasn't a village, as this seems a uniquely British term, but I wouldn't have ordinarily called it a town. Just a slick, snowy road, forking ahead, left and right, with some crumbling industrial buildings, a shuttered and decaying old-time saloon-style inn, and a small post office being the only signs of life. We turned as one and looked up over a snowy rise. A church, then set further back the tops of some other buildings. We walked, frozen, up a curved icy path past one building with signs and arrows directing us to another, with more arrows pointing in different directions. One to a shower, and the other saying, porter cabin bunkhouses. We slogged and slid silently upwards through the flat light of the early evening. Two units, two separate cubicle porter cabin rooms. We peered through the frosted window to check it was the right place, happily seeing a worktop and two bunk beds. Praying they were open, we stepped up onto the unmarked snow of the porch and tried the door. It gave inwards, and our shoulders sagged with relief. We piled in after taking our shoes off and leaving them outside, but still we tracked in snow and ice onto the plastic-filmed laminate floor. I bent to crank on the heating bar. It took hours to heat that damn room. Bunkhouse hung up his thermometer and we kept checking it, intermittently jumping off our bunks onto the burning cold, uninsulated floor. We'd all pulled out our quilts and couldn't speak much until we felt less ill from the low temperature and exertion. I leaned back and looked at the bottom of the bunk above me, wincing as Fitbit moved next to me, her wet, puffy jacket huffing out a belch of warm hiker stink. We sat in twos on the bottom bunks, shivering, staring at the walls and reading the graffitied wood of the old units, too cold to move for quite some time. We started with snacks, then cooked food, all in relative silence, bar the rustles of blankets, quilts, and bags. We were all desperate for the loo, but too scared to go outside in the ice storm. It was too cold and extremely stultifying in the cabin. Adventuring into the neighbouring unit provided nothing more. The hiker box was minimal and discarded, with few people coming into Troutdale, and fewer still to this bunkhouse. After some searching on the walls, we saw a B&B advertised for hikers. Spud looked it up on her downloaded Guthook app. The reviews were poor. It was overpriced, and the reviews hinted at something distinctly odd. But I called them with the tiny bit of service I had. They weren't pleasant. Not to me or to any of us who called. The B&B team were a stern, mean woman and a man shouting dissent and annoyance in the background. We had only really called to arrange a slack pack the next day so we could get up and over Rowan Mountain. But they scoffed at our foolishness and refused to drive us in such cold weather. When, on the second time, I said I was a journalist, a fib, but I didn't care, she warmed up, keen for us to stay at their place, and wheedled for us to pay for her B&B for two nights, and then she'd help us. She stressed that the porter cabin was dangerously cold, with no one else around. I explained that some of us couldn't afford to pay, so that's why we were in this church shelter. "How many can't afford it?" she pressed. "One could work for staying and help me in the kitchen with food prep and cleaning." It was strange. They were strange, and I didn't enjoy talking over her inflated rates through her vacillating mood swings. We cut a deal that we were going to remain where we were and call her at 7 a.m, thinking that they'd probably capitulate and drive us to the trailhead. We just wanted to keep going. For the rest of the evening, we tried to get warm. We ate, chatted, and got ready for bed. Spud and Bunkhouse played cards, as they often did. Bunkhouse struggled to sit still, so went through the hiker box with a fine-tooth comb, announcing all the items out loud to us, making coffee and running water errands to the pavilion. I lay back on my bunk as conversation faltered, and we tried to sleep with the snowy wind howling through cracks like the devil denied. I touched my nose and mouth and cheeks, all cracked and dry from the terrible cold. One big breath in to ease the tension in my chest was also one inhalation of the stinking miasma of my friend Fitbit's jacket, and that was enough to wipe me out. I rolled over to the single pane glass by my head and shoved a discarded buff into the crack, rolled back, and sank into a sleep like the dead. Our plan didn't fly. The Troutdale equivalent of the Twits deliberately refused to take us to the trailhead, knowing that we wouldn't last another day in the porter cabin as they gloated down the phone about their huge log burner and the warm home we could stay in. We gave in, and he came to pick us up, a huge, serious man swathed in ceremonial robes, and took us on a 3-minute drive, for which we were charged a shuttle fee, to their house. It was a strange bungalow oozing normalcy, but with a dystopian undertone we couldn't quite explain. After listening to an introduction monologue from his wife about how she was suing his family for the estate of his dead mother, and him chipping in that they're all money-grabbing whores, she informed us of their strict faith and the holy standards of their home. No drinking, no entry to here, here, and here, no long showers, no extra blankets, nothing for free. Everything above a bed was billable. No entry to the kitchen, no exit from the rear. The whole place was really a pile of nope. I was grossed out by them and their home, she obsequious and hand-rubbing, and he a sinister authoritarian presence in the background. We wanted to leave as soon as we arrived, but we were trapped by an ice storm, the location, and a lack of taxis, having already exhausted every other shuttle number for the area. It wasn't until later that one of us realised why our accommodation felt so strange, and that moment made us feel a little sick. Our single beds in a series of small rooms with lino floors. The counters on one wall, with kitchen-style cupboards below and space for a rolling chair, wipe-cleaned surfaces and a sink placed mid-worktop. The perfunctory doors and handles, the strange reception hatch where the wife sat to bark questions, locking the door behind her to sit and glare at us through sliding glass when there were only four of us here. Bunkhouse spotted it first. "Guys," he said quietly, even though we could see the large hostile couple were moving to leave for their own house next door. "Guys, don't freak out, but I think this place was a doctor's surgery." All of us took a split second to consider, and then our faces contorted. Light dimming, tree shadows moving in the wind across the floor where we sat by a fire. Dear Lord, controlling hosts in a disused surgery, miles from anywhere, in a dilapidated industrial town. We had walked into a horror film. Later, padding across the cold lino by my bed with bare feet and barricading the door with my pack, I imagined who had lain in this space before they had wheeled a flimsy cheap bed in here. How many tears, scrapes, results revealed I lay on. Christ, I couldn't wait to get out. Finally, the weather lifted and we were able to leave. We paid through the nose to escape and started our ascent to the Grayson Highlands, a top spot for hikers with its wild ponies and breathtaking views. Alongside these, in mid-November, we also faced storms of ice crystals, snowdrifts, and exposed balds where the wind cut us near in half, but the ponies were warm and welcoming. After ice and snow at elevation, we hot-footed it to Damascus, the trail town loved for its annual Trail Days festival, and a veritable constant welcome party for hikers. Trail magic raised its head again, in the guise of Chris from the Vermont Magic, booking me a room ahead of time at Crazy Larry's hostel. Larry, a slightly eccentric character with a heart of gold and a checkered past, was a delight. He was a Hemingway-esque writer, with tales of running to the AT on the lam from the cops and jail cell revelations with the Lord shared over grits and bacon at his breakfast table. We enjoyed his hospitality, rode bicycles for a day to give our walking legs a break, and lolled around watching TV and drinking beer. Then we took our leave under the famous Damascus Arch and crossed over into Tennessee. Tennessee, 287.9 miles. North Carolina, 95.5 miles.
I need to remember how I feel right now, so I'm recording myself for me. I'm supposed to be this person that's really brave, but I can't sleep outside by myself. I get terrified when it gets to be nighttime and I'm on my own. I want to hike the CDT, want to hike the PCT, want to hike Tierra. How am I going to do any of these things when I can't sleep out by myself? How am I supposed to present myself as someone who's this brave outdoorsy person when I'm too scared? And when I say too scared, I mean the thought when it gets dark and there's no one else around is of absolute terror and I don't know how to get past it. It just feels like I'm definitely going to die or get attacked. Like it's definite. Like, if I accept that I'm going to sleep out by myself in a shelter and it gets dark, that is something that is definitely going to happen to me. And I don't know what I can do to get over it. If I don't get over it, I'm never going to be that person that I want to be. It's just someone who is out here and is truly self-sufficient. And I'm so angry. but that thing that happened to me all those years ago has left me, someone who's so capable in so many other places and areas of my life, has left me unable to do this simple thing that an 18-year-old girl I'm hiking with can do, that all these women I meet do blithely and enjoy it. And I want to so badly.
Chapter 22, Giving Thanks. The trail through Tennessee and North Carolina wove in and out of each other's borders like stitching a muddy quilt together, often leaving us not knowing where on earth we were. One way of knowing was that the Tennessee shelters often didn't have privies at shelters at all. Quite a shock after becoming used to having them every now and then. We managed, though, following the leave no trace principles and respecting the trail despite the bone-chilling cold. These weeks were further blurs of ice and snow. There was silence through the woods as the layers of autumn were pressed down upon by the heavy foot of winter. We passed through Pisgah and Cherokee, picking up random and delicious trail magic from walkers and day visitors to parks and viewpoints, who were keen to find someone to gift things to. Hikers were hard to find out here in late November, and just as trail angels couldn't find us to nurture, we couldn't find the angels we needed. Luckily, though, there were still some homemade cakes and cans of beer to be found in hollows, car parks, and the trunks of trucks that stopped to holler hello to us at the trailheads. When we got to Irwin, the little trail family I was with asked if I wanted to join them on a side trip into the city of Asheville. Bunkhouse had a room booked with two double beds and a car rented to go there to meet his parents. We were all invited. I ummed and ahed for a while as, although the offer was tempting, I was worried it would eat into the short time I had left to get myself to the terminus at Springer Mountain and catch my flight. But with the other three all going and Fitbit assuring me we could fit it all in, I threw caution to the wind and jumped in with them. I was so glad I did. A couple of days in a cool city wasn't such a shock to me after having been home to the UK recently, and it was really interesting to see what life was like for people off-trail in this part of the USA. We explored antique stores, drank in microbreweries, and bought homemade spicy jerky and hot sauces for our packs. After our city adventure, we drove down past the AT to the town of Hot Springs. Spud and Bunkhouse had cooked up an interesting plan. You see, it was soon to be Thanksgiving, and although I had my doubts about celebrating, it was truly a time that families in the USA liked to get together, cook together, and open their homes. The hiker families were no different, and every year a kind trail angel would gather together all the hikers that were still on trail within an 80-plus mile radius and put on a huge hiker Thanksgiving for them all. She'd source volunteers from all around the community to cook trays of delicious food and donate beers and spirits for everyone, and it was something that had been talked about on trail and social media for weeks. We had a plan to hike in and enjoy the fun too, but this year the location of Hiker Thanksgiving was different from in years past, and if we continued as we would hike past it about 5 days before it happened. It was to be set in Irwin, and our clever plan was to drive down trail to the famously welcoming Laughing Heart Hostel, check in for a night and stash our gear, and then hike northbound back up the trail to Irwin to enjoy Thanksgiving. From there, our lovely hosts at Laughing Heart, Ty and Solo, who would drive up to join in the Thanksgiving, would drive us back down to their hostel for a night's rest and to collect gear before we set out southbound again from their place. It was a bold plan, but it worked a charm. Fitbit and I had fairly similar paces, hers being faster than mine with my damaged foot, but not fast enough to break past me into the next day. We also enjoyed hiking together, so we buddied up to hike the 70-ish miles back into Irwin. Spud and Bunkhouse were very fast, so they lingered a little longer and set off later with a slack pack organised and much heftier mileage. It took a few days, but we made it to Irwin in good time for the festivities. We met some nice folk coming southbound on the trail as we headed north, and it was interesting to meet people who would be otherwise hiking too far ahead of us to have met naturally. Hiking north initially felt like cheating on southbound, but we settled into it and were just glad to be ticking off miles. We took turns waiting for each other, as the evenings were drawing in more quickly and neither of us loved hiking in the dark alone. We had our reasons, and they were occasionally amplified. One man I passed late one dusky afternoon asked to photograph me and snapped pictures as I went by. But other than that creepy interlude, after which I hiked knife in hand for a few miles, I was safe and happy. Fitbit fetched water for me at camp when my foot was too painful for extra mileage, and I shared food and other kindnesses with her. We generally settled into a supportive cadence of each other's sporadic company through the day and campmates at night. She'd string her hammock across the front of the shelter that I'd sleep in, and we'd keep each other safely company in the dank, early dark evenings. I was damn glad to have her as my hiking partner and friend. We arrived in time to drink a late morning beer and get into the swing of festivities. Hiker Thanksgiving was a busy feast down by the river, with heavily laden tables that we were positively drooling to get our hands on. Both the outdoor and indoor spaces were full of hikers from up and down trail that we had heard of but not yet met. And after eating piles of delicious food, we began to play games and chat. There were folk of all ages and nationalities, drawn as if by a magnet towards this hospitality from within a cold and wintry 200-mile radius. We had been brought together for a few hours like long-lost family. I spoke to many hikers I didn't know and caught up with those I'd only met briefly before at springs and shelters. Chatter was as high as the vibes, and laughter filled the air along the banks of the Nolichucky River. Firm friendships being formed around the huge fire, with some strong drinks to boot, before it was time to go home. I marvelled at the fact I'd come so far, and felt so at home here, with these athletic, driven, outdoorsy folk. This wasn't the me that started this trail, just the me in my mind I had always wanted to become. I realised, standing in that moment, that obstacles don't stop coming, no matter what we achieve. We never entirely arrive if we keep pushing ourselves, because there are always new boundaries to push. This is no bad thing. Every time I had met my own limits, I had managed to step through them into something new, something unprecedented. It was reassuring to know that we will always find a new way to cope with adversity. We just need to be willing to fall forwards into trusting our own resilience and power. I always knew that beyond my chronic illness was a different life, and that the force of my will to recover and thrive would take me there. And now I knew that I had room to grow so much further beyond those limits too. I truly realised, standing with a cider in hand and the sun on my face, discussing the next long trail I'd hike, that there are no limits except those we place on ourselves. And then, just like that, the sun was dipping and the day was drawing to a close. We piled into the back of Ty and Solo's camper, tipsy and smiling. Bunkhouse, Spud, Boppet, Kid, Fitbit and myself, happiness tanks full, ready for the final stretch. Chapter 23, Into the Smokies. Fitbit and I were on our own now, and it was getting cold as hell. The incomparable free spirits and big hearts, Ty and Solo, had dropped us to the trailhead from their hostel, with full packs, full bellies, and the warm glow of having been in a place that ran on love and kindness. Laughing Heart Hostel had soothed us all, especially me, with my battered, agonising feet. Compensation, away from the pain of tendonitis, had allowed deep blisters to form across the sides and balls of my feet, and now socks pulled away thick layers of flesh with bright pink open wounds beneath. Walking was a punishment until the cold and painkillers disassociated me from my lower legs over the course of a morning's hobbling. We nattered for a while, and then Fitbit's longer legs took her off into the leaves and branches, pulling ahead until I couldn't see her. Drizzle came through, so my brolly went up, cleverly propped under my front strap and held firm against my chest. I figured I'd be an outlier with the umbrella, and I was, but instead of giggles, the most common reaction was, "Ah, shucks," envy, and asking where I'd got it from, as people straggled past, soaked and miserable. Today, though, there wasn't anyone around to comment one way or another, the pathways ghostly and still. Every now and then, I caught sight of Fitbit ahead, always stopping to photograph any set of steps with over 4 rises for her postgrad project, for which she'd received funding for the trail. She had stopped and photographed every set of stairs on the whole trail, counting the rises for each and noting stone, wood, etc., and was still faster than me. Ha! Here towards the end of the journey I cared so much less about it, where I was, how far behind. My limits were my limits, and I was working with them to grow rather than railing against them and pushing. Plus, my foot was deeply painful, the cold making the bone-deep throbbing a near constant now. So slower was okay, except close to dark, of course. Still can't shake that primal fear. Will I ever? White blazes loomed on stakes across hilltops through the mist, feeling alien and other. But soon the path turned sharply downwards, moving from muddy slope to cut mud steps, then wooden risers to concrete stairs and a metal railing. We were hitting a highway. It was always unsettling to descend and hit civilization. That didn't change, but it was especially so when the high mountains were so wild and the street level so mundane. Highway signs, cars whizzing past, giving eyebrow raises and uncertain glances. What were we to them in their warm cocoons heading from one indoors to the next? Perhaps vagrants. Perhaps hippies. Once you venture more than a few miles from the trail in any direction, your cachet decreases, and your move from "hiker, let's help them out," to "crazy person, stay away from them," is swift. Over the next few days, we kept our mileage as high as we could, with darkness descending early and dawn taking its time to come. It was early December, and snow was coming. I could feel it, and the weather forecast told me so. The tickle of worry in my tummy that wouldn't fade was all about that weather and its trajectory towards our next target, the Smokies, our final fierce mountain range before the end. I had few days left and none to spare, and I couldn't afford a weather day. My trail buddy had more time, so she could wait out a storm, but she didn't really want to hike alone either, not now, in the dead of winter, when so few people were around and conditions were so much more dangerous. She was also a purist, so even if I wanted to jump a day to fill it in when I could come back in spring, she wouldn't. It was a tricky juggling act, and it was clear I was going to have to sacrifice something somewhere if I wanted to finish this journey at the AT's finish point for Sobos, Springer, before Christmas. Through Waynesville, through Cosby, and at Green Corner Road near Hartford, we crossed the road up into the Smokies, posting our permit notifications into the box near the parking lot. It had started to snow, and the afternoon light was already dim. We debated. Should we go up? It was still nearly 5 miles of elevation up to Cosby Knob Shelter, and the snow was coming down thickly now. 5 miles, all up steps and slippery narrow paths that gripped sheer walls and dropped into rhododendron-covered abysses. I was so happy to be doing this with Fitbit. We started out. Hiker clothing is light and quick dry. Hikers also don't carry more than they need to. Except me. I always carry more than I need to, and none of it is useful beyond the one singular occasion where I might need that one specific thing, which never happens. Even so, there weren't many layers to pull on to deal with this snow, and every layer that did get pulled on was soaked through, either from the inside out from sweat or the outside in from snow. My ultras, shoes that I loved fiercely despite their innate ability to fall apart, were mesh-topped and my feet were now snowy over the ankles. The heat of my toes melted any flakes that landed and my ankles were treated to near constant tiny avalanches into my socks. It wasn't fun. Really, I knew that I was looking for any reason to stop, but there isn't any ad hoc stopping in the Smokies. The rules are strict, and you have to sleep only in shelters. You can't even hammock or tent. Everyone in, together. I was imagining a claustrophobic space, filled with hikers even at this time of year. Nowhere for them to disperse. I also contemplated yelling to Fitbit for us to put our tents up here. Anywhere, no one would stop us. And hiking on in the snow as we increased our elevation in the growing darkness was not a solid plan. The words were in my mouth, but I couldn't say them because I knew I didn't have time to stop. Pressing onwards was the only option. A side trail to the beautiful Mount Camara emerged ahead in pristine white blankets of soft drifts. Fitbit stood waiting. "I really want to go see it. Will you come? Thought you might want to too. I don't know how clear it's going to be, but come, it's worth it." She smiled and gestured into a drift of snow. Fuck, I really wanted to. I'd seen photos of friends who'd been there for sunsets, and the sun was indeed setting now. But it was also dim, cold, and my foot was brutalizing me. On the other hand, though, how could I let her go alone? It wouldn't be wise to split up at this time of the evening, no? Or was that my fear talking? I couldn't really tell anymore, and had kind of given up trying to work it out. "Mate, you go, but I'll get to the shelter now and get things set up for you. Gather some wood if I can find anything dry, and get a fire going. Go, enjoy. Take some photos for me." "Are you sure?" "I understand, though, your foot and all, you know?" I appreciated her giving me an out and not highlighting my slow pace, age and general knackeredness. "Yep, all good. See you up there. Have fun." I threw the words over my shoulder as I turned and headed up, up, up some more. Too cold for me. The kind of cold that your brain tells you suddenly you should be worried about. I think that's at least better than the kind that tells you it's all okay, though, when you're too far gone and blue. It wasn't a fun walk. I had my buff pulled up and over my mouth, meeting the top of my hood pulled low. My eyesight was obstructed in order to keep warm, but my knees and shins paid the price, scraping rock edges hidden in soft, snowy disguises. The dusk was upon me, and my heart rate rose in harmony with it. I started singing to myself out loud to ward off the fear and the tingly heat in my hands. Snow dropping off thick leaves to my left and right gave my heart extra beats and a fierce pump of adrenaline. Not long to the shelter. Not far to the shelter. Not far. Slow. I was so much slower than usual. I stopped to fuss with my bag and yank out the head torch I knew I was going to need soon. So hard to understand exactly when was right. Too soon and you lost all vision apart from that directly in front, but too late and you risked a trip or a fall. I rested the torch's thick band over my hat and tucked it down into my neck, ready to switch it on, ready for anything. Not ready for a stream that had crept its watery fingers across the narrow ledge and frozen solid. My favoured foot skated out to the left. I was airborne. The ultras aren't as grippy as I'd like. I watched myself in the moment, slowed down and limbs moving in different directions, like a series of frames from Inception. I wondered idly whether I'd go over the edge, giving in to the fall. Nope, I didn't. One knee hard down on raised bobbles of black ice, one face scraped on tree roots that stretched from the wall, and one leg immersed to the knee in mulch and freezing mud over the edge. Not bad. Better than dead, and enough to give me relief. I stayed there for a moment to gather myself. Sometimes you need to do that, don't you? Catch your breath, appreciate the moment. I rolled over and sat down, caring not a bit that my ass was now in snow and everything was wet. I was bathed in the heated flush of post-fear that warmed me. Shocked, I moved to my usual comfort reflex, pulling my phone out of my pocket on automatic pilot. Did I have service? No, none. My wet glove idly poked the photo app, and I looked at the last few photos I'd taken, scrolling back further and further to get away from this moment in the cold and dark. I looked at a picture of a warm wood burner and my cozy bed at Laughing Heart. Finally, I felt the wet coldness on my butt cheeks and got up. Looking up from the phone screen, it was clear I'd idled away the last minutes of good light. Fuck! Fuckity fuck! I was literally my own worst enemy. Don't like being last? Okay, let's idle away precious minutes of hiking and break my consistency with phone scrolling. Need to catch up with people? Oh yes, let's chat to strangers on trail instead. Always standing squarely in my own way on the daily, and then wildly flailing for ways to improve my life and situation. My brain. Excuse me, ma'am, couldn't you just step to the side with your bad habits? Regardless, it was now dark, and the fresh pain of my throbbing knee had recruited the bastard foot into a duet. I pulled up the head torch, ready to valiantly make it to the shelter and make a damn fire for my friend, pressed the button, strapped it on tighter, and looked up. Jesus, it was so dim, like waggling a glowworm's bum around. I used it to get over the slippery ice ribs, then stopped in the snowy swamp around the bend, under some branches to save fresh snowfall getting on what I was about to do. Pack swung heavily off my shoulder and onto the ground. I ferreted around inside and then emerged triumphant with fresh batteries. Yes! Ha ha! It was worth me carrying all this crap. This was a moment of validation for the non-ultralight hiker. I had batteries on lock. Then the multi-job tango began of holding my iPhone between my teeth for light, removing old batteries with one hand and having the new ones ready to go in. There was a moment between the two where dropping my phone would be super bad, as it was now dark, dark. My cold fingers worked. Proud I wasn't too ham-fisted or accidentally flicking the faded batteries out into snow. Neatly, I popped them inside the maw of my fanny pack and then flipped the new ones in, a little bit of dribble spooling down the side of my phone as I looked down to focus with the back of it between my teeth. They were in! Good job, and thank God, the battery on my phone was a precious commodity. My anchor packs were amazing, but weren't holding charge like they used to after 6 months of constant use. And we were now 3 days from the next supply spot in this weather. Still using the phone, I packed all my shit away and slung my pack up on my back, feeling the cold wetness like a fresh winter's kiss. I put the head torch in place again, phone off, finger up to depress the button, press, ready for high wattage joy and... nothing. Nada. Zero light. Fucking hell. I gave it a little jiggle, and then a shake. Maybe I put the batteries in the wrong way around. No, I double-checked for sure. But maybe I didn't. I was so tired lately. Okay, let's have a look. But now it was totally dark. Okay, iPhone again. I opened the head torch case, but everything looked fine. Perhaps these weren't good batteries anymore. Oh, for Christ's sake! I had carried shit dead batteries all this way. I was indeed the lamest hiker in God's green land. Nothing for it but to swap the glowworm batteries back in. Down went the pack again, off with the outer gloves, off with the inner gloves tucked under armpits and dropped on the snow. Into the fanny pack the new batteries went, trying to crane over my chest to see down into it in the dark with my phone, digging for the old ones. Grabbed them. Well, them and all the other paraphernalia that comes tumbling out of a fanny pack in the dark when you're fishing around for small, heavy things that have fallen to the bottom. I was beginning to lose my rag, but shoved the old batteries in. I used my phone light to scrape up all the detritus from the ground, and then stood up to toggle the head torch switch again. Still nothing. This couldn't be right. I poked it hard, thumbed it, and then dropped it in fury. Threw my head back with my eyes closed, clenched my fists by my side, and bellowed, "For fuck's sake!" around my little evergreen snow ledge and out into the ether. Much later, in total darkness, after half feeling my way along the path and sporadically using my phone light, I arrived at the shelter, a stone building which was much like an old grain barn with one wall blown off and now covered by a loose flapping tarp with bottom edges tucked in by snow. I ducked in the gap, knowing from the darkness and silence that no kindly souls were here to greet me with a fire and hearty hello. I had a job to do, though, and I was going to bloody do it. The snow was relentless, and Fitbit was coming. She had to be. Some damn good human had left a small pile of twigs inside, away from the elements, with some larger logs stacked next to them. I started trying to light the fire and sat back to see if it sank or swam, whilst imagining where she might be and how she might find the route now under the snow a good 2 hours later. Happily, she arrived to the crackling orange glow of conviviality. The only light I really had. No warmth, though, as the gap between tarp and wall sucked out any heat, but the colour of the flames helped us imagine warmth. The lookout was worth it. She showed me photos. We made our nests, put on all of our clothes after peeling off the wet, cold ones to freeze overnight, her, or to put in my sleeping bag with me so they were at least warm and damp in the morning. I'd also somewhere lost my spoon, so food was tricky. No head torch, no spoon, little warmth, and very little phone battery, with 4 more days ahead in the snowstorm that was being forecast, it wasn't boding well. So I tucked myself deeply in my triple layers up on the top wooden platform and watched Fitbit climb into the hammock she'd slung between the beams over my legs and tried to dream of warmth, respite from pain, and a clear pathway for the morrow. We woke early and to pin drop silence. Every head movement brought an unsealing of the nest-like warmth in my bag and started me a little more awake each time. A full look up and out was going to be like dipping my head in a bucket of ice water, but I needed to know what it looked like through the gap to the outdoors. The cold shock opened my eyes wider, but I wasn't ready to speak yet, let alone yelp. I inched myself to the edge of the platform under Fitbit's hammock and looked down and out. Her eyes peeped over the lip of fabric. "Can you see that down there? Look." She gestured to the floor, a tiny white creature darting back and forth on the ground, then jumping high and swooping back down, an arc of slick white liquid. It had heard me move above, but wasn't too perturbed, watching me momentarily before waterfalling itself across the floor and out into the snowdrift, which I now noticed was knee-height against the gap between tarp and wall. "Weasel," she said, and it was. Such a joy out here to not only see nature, but to be as another animal rather than a spectator of it. The danger of being back in a food chain in our position before guns and dominance was far outweighed on this journey by the pleasure of being accepted by creatures and seen as just another beast. Getting out of our sleeping bags hurt like hell. "It's like being born every morning," I wailed, doing the fast switch from peeling back the bag, taking sleep clothing off and exposing bare skin to the frigid air for as short a time as possible before the day layers went on. God help you if you had forgotten to put them in the bottom of your sleeping bag the night before, because you'd be unfolding frozen layers of fabric down on yourself and using precious body heat to thaw them before the clothes eventually capitulated and started to warm you up instead. "What do you think?" Fitbit had come out behind me and was rounding the back wall again after a morning pee, our yellow patches melting pee tunnels to the earth like lightning strikes in a child's cartoon. "I don't know. Can we get service?" We bounced around with phones aloft, sliding down snow into unseen gaps between unseen logs, our legs burning, then numb through light leggings and shorts. I sent a weather request on my inReach, and that eventually pinged through at the same time Fitbit managed to get a ranger report. It didn't look good. Snow was set to start again in a few hours and lay down a few feet on top of the drifts we were already facing. On the top ridgelines where we were heading and had many miles to cover, rangers were warning of blizzards and danger. "Don't venture out," was the plea. "Don't risk our lives and yours by getting stuck in the Smokies." The starker message was that they might not even be able to come and provide rescue. What about the others? Spud, Bunkhouse, what will they do? She thought for a moment. "Last I heard, they were about one shelter ahead of us. I bet they've stayed hunkered down there. They're high up. They won't be able to move backwards or forwards. It'll be all day for them and another night in that shelter. I hope they have fuel, light and wood." "They will," I said, nodding. "They knew this might be coming in. It'll be too dangerous to try to get down to Gatlinburg today. But listen, I don't know if I can take a couple days sitting in shelters. My deadline's so tight. I don't have light, I don't have batteries, no spoon, phone dying. I just think it might be best to go down." Fitbit looked so sad. She was keen to go on, but it just wasn't an option, and staying for 24 hours in this frozen shelter when there was a hostel 5 miles back the way we had come seemed masochistic. It meant going backwards, and no one wanted to hike back down the way they'd already come, especially considering what a massive uphill slog it had been to get here. But return we did, passing one lone hiker who said he was prepared for the worst and had heavy winter weather gear, appraising our light hiking clothes with some measure of shock. It was a miserable and frozen duo who walked into the yard of a bizarre hostel, set miles from anywhere up a narrow road. Gunfire deafened our approach, and when we finally found a wild-looking man, after poking around the wooden outhouses for a moment, yelling that we'd arrived, he explained, mumbling, "Goddamn fucking morons. Told them not to shoot the damn coyotes, but they won't listen to shit." My eyes went wide as dinner plates. 7 months in this country, and I still wasn't used to guns. I was now accustomed to passing hunters with them on trail, but hearing them being fired, especially in such close proximity, was a whole other thing. Fitbit and I checked out the bunkhouse and saw evidence of another hiker we'd been polite to but avoiding where we could. A nice enough guy, but too eager to befriend and offer booze or weed, with little understanding of no or the need for personal space and plenty to say about how much he liked us. He'd been making progress through the trail, but had seemed to stall out over the last few hundred miles, limping from place to place and overstaying his welcome, offering to help out for his room and board, and drinking too much. We asked the wild-looking man, Jim, who was renting the bunk, just to be sure. "God damn that guy. He's a nice enough asshole, but we've been trying to get rid of him. He's been here days. He's so annoying." He looked quickly over to check we weren't friends about to defend the man. We weren't. How can someone be so annoying even when they're sober? He wondered aloud, scratching his beard. Anyway, he'll be out back drinking whiskey and shooting them guns with the morons out there. I kind of think he's got a moonshine vibe about him. And Jim trailed off as he walked ahead, lost in thought. So where could we stay if not there? I asked him. Oh, we got a cabin free. Got a stream that goes under it. Kind of pretty. Cold, though, but so is everything. We jumped at it and settled in for the night. Various bearded men in multi-layers and fur hats came to the door through the grey and snowy day, bringing plates of homemade turkey soup, freshly baked rolls and Pabst blue ribbons, setting them by the fire and sharing snippets of the action outside. "They're looking for the dogs now," exclaimed Feather on one visit. "Shooting those damn coyotes meant the little dogs done run away. Small little things. They ran off together." He looked sad. "They only small."
"Oh, no."
"Yep, they often run away. But now with this ice and snow, they won't figure out how to get back. We are going out looking." And he withdrew, poking his head back in to say briefly, "You girls want a beef burger? Can make you up a triple each. Just found some old meat in the freezer out back. Can put some special mustard on it." We shook our heads and smiled nicely at him. No fucking way. And he was gone. Later, as the dark crept in fully and we'd organized a ride, he returned with some more beers and propane for the fire. "Dogs are probably dead," he said, placing the tins on the wooden floor above the sound of the rushing river and turning, leaving without another word. I dreamed of coyotes with new pack members, huddling together for warmth, and two small dogs who had just started the adventure of their lives. We'd picked up a ride with Fitbit's friend Elk, who had just completed her flip-flop through hike and was heading home, keen to deliver trail magic on her way back. She scooped us up the next day and drove us along the length of the impenetrable Smokies. We were sad, feeling the loss as the fast car made mockery of our efforts. In order to have a shot at making my flight, we needed to be taken as far as the Nantahala Outdoor Centre, a good few miles past the exit of the Smokies proper, and I knew, without doubt, that I'd be back to fill them in as soon as the winter snows thawed in a few months' time. And so, rested, we began again, over snowy hills and trails into Georgia, closing in on the final miles, feeling a sense of unreality. Me, nursing the agony of my tendonitis, and Fitbit, the purist, aghast at her mile skipping. Georgia, 76.4 miles.
I'm on my way up Springer. I've got about 2.2 miles to go up there. And I'm thinking about how I feel about getting to Springer. And I think I don't feel a lot. Like, it's an inevitability, thankfully, that I can get here. Well, it's an inevitability that this is where I've been going. But for me, I think, having thought about it last night, the whole thing has been about, here's a start point, here's an end point, and here's a lot of unknown thrown in the middle. Challenge, adversity, the potential for catastrophe, joy, terror, learning, relationships, disappointment, and that's what it's all been about. It's been about everything except for the beginning and the end, for me. So the end is wonderful, but it's really just a threshold for me to the next challenge,
What can I do? Where can I put myself that's so far out of my comfort zone that it terrifies me, but I do it anyway? To see how far I can go, I am going to sit and write all the things that this has taught me, that I've learned about myself, about my relationships, how I make them, how I value myself, how to make a lighter pack, how to be a better backpacker, who I am, how I contribute better, how I contribute to the world, and how I can do it better, how I can be a better friend, more selfless. It's been great. It's been really good. And don't quite know how to put it into words what this trail's given me, and the confidence it's given me in myself again, in my body. How grateful I am for everyone that has helped me on the way. People who have very little, who've given everything. They don't have very much themselves, but they open up their door and they bring you in and they give you every single thing they have. It's helped me be a better person. And thank you to all of those people who've helped me along the way, all the trail angels, the people at home who've encouraged me, mostly the people along this trail who keep it going, and the other hikers who are learning too, and everyone's like pinballing into each other on different trajectories of learning and fear and hope, and but we're all on one path. We're just like barreling around on this tiny strip trying to elevate ourselves or learn. Anyway, I better get my fucking lazy ass up this mountain.
Chapter 24, Where We Have Become One. Only 76 miles. A surreal concept. I didn't feel like I knew any other life now, and even though my month off trail recovering had taken me back into the bustle of real life, since my return, I had felt I was back where I should be, where it felt like coming home. The 3 days of slack packing through the state that would take us to the top of Springer Mountain were a slow ascent from the depths, an inverted suffocation, as though it was only when I burst through the surface to the end of the trail that I would be unable to breathe anymore. I breathed with the trees now. We had found a sweet couple that ran a B&B off-trail and were happy to slack pack us. We were a week into December and too cold and exhausted to go fast or far with full packs. My foot pain had reached Virginian levels and I was contorting my body to move forwards with breathless gasps when my toes caught on rocks or twigs. My foot was strapped with multi-moleskins and bandages over the broken skin. I had lost both big toenails now, and so my poor feet pulsed with pain inside and out. Not far. We could make it. Down past Chunky Gal Trail, through Blairsville and Neil's Gap, where the shoes dangled in their hundreds from a large tree by the road. It was here that northbound hikers in the early stages of their through had come far enough to know they needed to stop, and so they flung their shoes into the tree, a statement of defeat, or, couched differently, a proud announcement of knowing one's limits. Either way, in the frosted fog of a rainy dawn in December, it was bleak to see. But we smiled, Fitbit and I, because we were heading up Blood Mountain. And we were close. Close to rest, to ending, to achieving what we'd set out to do. Only the stain of the Smokies sat upon us. But we weren't arrogant enough to fight nature, so it was okay. Atop Blood Mountain, we were socked in completely with thick fog, the rocks slick and slippery with frost and rain. And then, as night came early, it was time for our last sleep together, here under the trees. Anticlimactic, peaceful, And not before time, we huddled our squeaking sleep pads next to each other and layered up for a final night against the elements. There wasn't much to say, but there was lots to laugh about. And now, in place of mile mapping and resupply planning, we were just enjoying. Laughter pealing through the naked boughs all around our final shelter. We had done it, and our friendship, though shorter than others on trail, was deep and true. We'd seen the core of each other in recent weeks, stripped back to the bones by the elements and effort. The next morning, the final morning, Fitbit pulled ahead as I struggled to tape and bandage my foot. Now, so swollen as to not fit inside my shoe, it made me feel unwell to look at it. I didn't know it then, but my foot was never suffering just from tendonitis. It was broken, in two places, with one fracture displaced. This was not to be discovered until I returned home to our glorious NHS and the x-rays that would show the damage, leaving the radiographer open-mouthed at what I'd managed to achieve with the injury. But here and now, I was still working with what I'd been told was an irritation to the tendon, one that I felt my pain threshold and tenacity should be well able to cope with. And so, just like every day, I found a way to push past the limit of the obstacle and forge forwards. Today my foot had become so distended that my laces needed to be left wide open. The elephantine-like flesh and bulbous ankle enough to hold the shoe in place. And so, nurse work done, I struck out for home. Each footstep a little death, yet also a little victory. A little voice. I will not be stopped. And I didn't stop, not until I was 3 miles from the summit, that incongruous summit of Springer, neither majestic nor awe-inspiring by sight, only by a sense of achievement wrought through arriving. I had been listening to podcasts and audiobooks through the freezing rain and mists of the last weeks, desperate to remove myself from the immediate reality of the heavy hours of movement. At this point, 3 miles out, I turned them off and stopped to take stock under the tip-tap of rain on my umbrella. What was I feeling? What had it all been for? It didn't feel like the final ticker tape, line-breaking achievement that I'd imagined. Originally about a start point and an end point, the messy middle was always going to be a morass of the unknown. Challenge, adversity, and the potential catastrophe that the wild outdoors can bring. Joy, terror, and learning. Relationships, disappointments, and heartbreak. That's what it had all really been about. Everything except the beginning and the end. I wasn't ever alone in the unknown. The others on this trail had been learning too, from hikers to angels, rangers to trail towns. The path brings us together and pinballs us into each other on different trajectories of learning and fear and hope. But we're all on one path. The dirt ribbon. Barreling around on this tiny singular strip, trying to elevate ourselves beyond what we are told our life is supposed to be. But I didn't feel a lot in this moment. Is that strange? My arrival at this place felt like an inevitability. Inevitable that with my grit and determined spirit I would have got here eventually, even if I had to drag myself a mile a day. So it wasn't a surprise to arrive, but it was a surprise to arrive so humbled. So opposite to the usual fist-pumping swagger of a challenge accomplished. I hadn't beaten my chronic conditions to finish hiking the trail. I had instead walked with my many broken, damaged parts until each of the pieces of me had reconciled with the others. Until I accepted them all as being me. I wasn't fixed, mended, and repaired. I wasn't born again freshly, with no scars, or gifted with a winner's medal. I was simply forgiven. By the forests, the people, and by the trail that had absorbed my tears of joy and sorrow for over 2,000 miles. By myself. James had been right all those months ago on that busy London street. I was always walking home, but the place was inside me all along. I had walked an unimaginable distance to reach my own front door and see myself as if for the first time, with love. And so now, regardless of endings or beginnings, I was arriving at this place with great reverence, quietly whole, to sit at the foot of the great trail and give my thanks. The trail had never seemed more like wisdom made material, into earth and trees, birdsong and ermine, rushing rivers and cleansing rain. The trail had given me the gift of acceptance, and I had never been so grateful for anything in my life. My final steps were slow and laboured, riven with steady determination. Up, up, up to the top, leaning heavily on my poles, but I made it to the flat stone place where the plaques rested. Plaques set into ancient stones, the recipients of countless thousands of fingertips and prayers. This was it, the end, the beginning. In the wind and freezing rain, I peeled off my glove and stretched out my chilled hand to the sign, flattening my palm on the bitterly cold letters. I closed my eyes, bowed my head, and gave thanks. The lesson had ended, and now the living would begin. This has been Unlost, written and narrated by Gail Muller. Copyright 2021 by Gail Muller. Production copyright 2021 by Thread, an imprint of Storyfire Limited. The moral right of the author has been asserted.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.